They're getting better, Sergeant. Okay. Oh, this is the last chance for questions. So tonight all your questions will be answered. At least those which aren't will never be answered. So here we go, the first one. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I had myself penciled in for my first interview with you today, but after some contemplation it dawned on me that our chat was not required. I realized... Someone has been realized. The answer to my question is somewhere inside of me. Yes. If I keep utilizing the skills you have taught me over the last 9 days, this answer and many more will pop up. Thank you for your time and guidance. Exactly. All the answers are within you. They're not in this box at all, so you can throw this box away, please. That's actually, I always remember one of my favorite monks, Ajahn Tate. Again, I went to go and see him and had all these questions, and as soon as you go into this presence, your mind was really silent. I just didn't have any questions. They all went. And so I remember saying to him, you ask me any questions? I said, I think it's probably best I find the answers myself. Yes, yes, well done, that's what you're supposed to do. Because you keep asking me these questions. Yes, sometimes you get good answers, sometimes you don't. You can't sort of hit the mark all the time. And even if you do give a right answer, sometimes you don't understand it anyway, so you answer the same question the next time you come on retreat anyway. So it's good to actually to answer yourself, and then once you answer yourself, it's finished forever. You mentioned in one of your talks that we don't have a choice but to be enlightened. Does that mean that we are all on the path to stream entry? Who knows? But basically, that somebody years and years and years ago, they came up and said, you know, once we hear these teachings, we can't forget them. Yeah, they go away for a while, but they always come back again. So once you see the bus, you have to get on it. So maybe on the path, who knows, see what happens. But for many of you, it's too late. Sorry. Thanks for your great meditation teachings. Yes, I deserve that. I told you that talk before, that when you get praise, receive it. Some wise person here with great sort of sensitivity and appreciation for great meditation teachings has said this, thank you for your great meditation teachings. And if I said, oh no, I'm actually abusing you. I'm saying that you're stupid by telling me that I'm a great meditation teacher. And it's wrong to actually abuse people and don't recognize their great wisdom in recognizing a great teacher in front of them. So I have great fun with this. That's why I say, look, you know, if you really are humble, if you really have humility, then you should be proud of it and let people know. Have you ever looked in the Guinness Book of Records? There's a section there, the most humble person in the whole world. However, since I joined your retreat 5 months ago, my meditation all messed up. Uh-oh. Okay, somebody's winding me up here. Thanks for your great meditation teachings. However, since I joined your retreat 5 months ago, my meditation all messed up. Before I was seeing limiters, now I can't even find peace in my meditation. How come? It's because you've lost the instructions. If your meditation's messed up, it's because you're trying to do something. Because you're aspiring. You know, this is the 4 aspirations. First of all, you aspire. And what's the next one? And then, inspiration. Inspiration is the first aspiration. You get inspired. And the next one is aspiration. You get so inspired you want to actually achieve it. You get inspiration. And then it gets very difficult. And that's called desperation. And the last one is expiration. You leave. The 4 aspirations. And they come one after the other. So be very careful. It's great to have inspiration, but stop aspiring. Stop wanting things. And that's why in this retreat I've told you, just be peaceful. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. And then you find your meditation is just so wonderful. As I said this morning, you know, that great sort of simile that when you want to be somewhere else, you're in prison. When you're happy to be here, you're free. So being happy to be here, this is, look, you're here now. You've arrived, so you might as well like it. So that's where we just learn how to be content with whatever's arised. We're just happy to be here. And when we're happy to be here, that's when we slow down and stop. When we slow down and stop, that's when we get deep meditations. So just have a refresher course on the instructions. Should we do sharing of merit after each round of our meditation session? If not, our guardian there will not protect us. Unseen beings will look for us. Ooh, maybe they've been looking for you already. Don't worry, you are protected. You are protected by Ajahn Brahm power. Which is actually very interesting that, you know, sometimes that, you know, if there's good monks or good monk or good people in a place, that lower beings can't come in. So, you know, this place is pretty well protected. So, you know, lower beings, if they want to come in, they've got to ask permission first of all, and they're not given that permission. So you are totally protected in this place. It was this great story of this lady a long time ago. She migrated to Perth, from Thailand. And after a while, you know, her father had died. She had some family back in Thailand, but, you know, they weren't really looking after her mum. So she invited her mum to come to Australia. Now, I think they had this family reunion visa. So she was very old, so she looked after her mother. But, you know, the mother being very old, sooner or later she got really sick. So the daughter put her in hospital. The daughter was actually really good. Now, we just camp out next to the bed. So, you know, the mother never needed a nurse. That was the daughter's job. And so she looked after her mother so well. It was really amazing to see. But sooner or later, the mother got worse and worse. And she wanted to find out whether she was going to die or not. So she went to one of the mediums in Perth. One of these spirit doctors. She's paid this spirit doctor $20 to go and find out whether her mother was going to survive or not. And the medium, all the medium needed was a $20 note, obviously, first of all. And then the name of the hospital, the ward number and the room number. She's going to sort of check up on her mother's astral body. So she got all the information, and then she went into this trance for now 20 minutes or so. And when she came out again afterwards, the first thing this medium did was give the $20 back to the woman. She said, "Why, you know, couldn't you find my mum?" "Oh, I found her. I went to the hospital, found the ward, found the room, but I just couldn't get in the room. I just couldn't get in there." I said, "I've never seen this before." This, you know, to the spirit doctor, it was like there's this big energy field around the mother, like a force field. And I just couldn't penetrate. I couldn't get in close enough to, you know, find out whether your mum's going to survive or not. "I've never seen this before. Who the heck is your mother?" And the tiger said, "Oh, she's a Buddhist nun. She's been a nun for the last 30 years. At which point the spirit doctor grabbed the $20. "You know, you should have told me beforehand. People like me can't get close to people like that." And actually, it's a wonderful sort of little story and anecdote, just actually what it's like, you know, for like spirit beings. If you're really a good person, they can't get close to you. There's no way they can penetrate you. There's a power of goodness. Which, you know, the way that these spirit beings will perceive it, you've got a force field around you that can't penetrate. So just even keeping 5 precepts is good enough, let alone all the 8 precepts you've been keeping, all the meditation you've been done. So basically, you're sort of impenetrable. So, you don't really need to share that merit. You're totally protected. But nevertheless, you know, if you want to do the sharing of merits, they usually wait until sort of the end of the retreat. Why do we do that? Look, if you're going to send some money to your relations, you know, it takes a lot with bank charges and transfer fees. So you accumulate as much money as you can, then you send it in one go. So that's what we do here. If you send it every evening, you know, the amount of bank fees and transfer fees to send your merit, you know, you lose a lot. So wait to the very end, you get heaps and heaps of merit, then you can transfer it, so as you get more sort of merit for your bucks. Okay, so we'll do it at the end. While respecting the need to address the issues raised yesterday about Dharmasara, I would also like to share that the nuns have been a great source of love and guidance to many people, including myself, over the past 10 years. There are so many good bricks present too, in addition to the crooked ones. That's really good, because it's very easy to criticize. And, you know, that criticism should be acknowledged. You know, they're real, so we should do that. But it's also to recognize the other side of the story and the good bricks as well. So, you know, we respect. I think, as somebody said, it is sometimes difficult to fulfill all the roles necessary, sort of, you know, of a modern-day monk or teacher or nun. No wonder I've talked with the other monks over tea time. We have these great conversations at tea time. Totally ridiculous. I'm very glad they're not taped. Otherwise, many people would lose. Yeah, we just have a good fun together. So we're thinking one day, what would be the perfect teacher, the perfect Ajahn? And one of the things we said, obviously they have to, you know, be entertaining, because, you know, just telling Dhamma is not good enough. You know, you want it to, you know, with a bit of fun and a bit of games, you want it to, you know, with lots and lots of sugar. So they have to be entertaining, but they have to be deep. And one of the important things, they have to be able to talk a lot. Because you guys like asking lots of questions. You don't want us to just sit here just with our mouths closed. And number two, they have to have a very strong digestion. They have to eat a lot. Because you like feeding us all. And they can't be too healthy, because when the monk gets sick, you love actually offering medicines. So the perfect monk is one who talks a lot, has a great sense of humour, is very deep meditation, and is also, is just, what do they call it, just... like a dustbin mouth, so you can put anything in there, and is very happy and eats a lot and always says thank you, but gets sick very often, so you can also look after them and give them lots of medicines. That's your perfect monk. It's very hard to find somebody like that. When you do find one, you usually kill them after a year or two. Okay, but the other things you have to do, you know, you have to actually, you know, be a bit of a diplomat sometimes in committee meetings and try and balance everything to inspire people. Also settle, because you know what it's like in committees. You've got, you know, 10, 12 people with different ideas, and they've all got the best will in the world. They're volunteers. They're trying to do the very best, but there'll always be some friction there. It's, you know, even just, you know, take two people and marry them together, see heaps and heaps of friction. They've done 12 people. So, you know, they're always trying their best, but sometimes there's a bit of argument, so you've got to settle that all down. And if you're a teacher, you've got to try and find some middle way between all this stuff. But actually, that reminds me of one of those great jokes. You know, it's this old Chinese saying. The old Chinese saying goes, "He who walks the middle path gets hit by traffic coming in both directions." It's a very profound saying. If you take sides, at least you only get hit by one stream of traffic. But if you try and be in the middle, you know, and try and, you know, you support one side, but, you know, you also respect the other side, then both sides hit you. So, she who walks the middle path gets hit by traffic coming in both directions. A very nice thing. So we try our very best. But it's really good, please bring up these things if they happen, so we can talk about them, but put them in the right context. That's why I remember the best way of giving a monk or a nun performance assessment. 5 bits of praise, first of all. Then the sandwich, the butt. And then 5 bits of praise afterwards. You get much more traction from the monks and the nuns that way. So usually, you know, that because I'm a very busy monk, usually after the 5 bits of praise I have to go off somewhere. That's my trick. Thank you, Ajahn, for such a peaceful, beautiful retreat center. My battery is charged with gratitude, and I have experienced peace and stillness. Your teachings and presence have been inspiring. Thank you also to Bianca for everything she has done to make our tummies happy. Thank you for Dania for her efforts to coordinate and manage everything. And thanks to the rabbit for teaching me loving kindness. Now, I added that. How do I keep my mind state positive, happy and peaceful once I get back to my life and its challenges? The answer to that is don't go back to your life and challenges. Stay here. Enjoy the peace. No, we have to go back. So that will be tomorrow's talk, always the last talk. Is, yeah, you're nice and peaceful, but what are you going to do when you get home? But the point is, you're not home yet. You're here. So you've run off into the future about what's going to happen when I get home. So stay here. You may never get home. That's another one of my favourite sayings. Never do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. Remember that. Never do today what you can put off until tomorrow, because you might die tonight. That's logical. One of these days you're going to die. I know it is. You die when you've got all your bags packed to go somewhere, and then you die that night, and you think, gee, what a waste of time packing all my bags. I wasted so much of my time, my last day on this earth, and how did I spend it? Yes. So, okay. How many people have got your bags packed already? Well, you got your bags packed, but we haven't left yet. You may never leave. Who knows? Thank you. Well, that was actually a song, wasn't it? But some hotel. California Hotel. You can check out, but you never leave. Maybe. Is that right? Aha. Just like Charter Grove. Thank you very much for providing this wonderful place for us to meditate. We are so fortunate in Perth. We have two lovely monasteries, Dhammaloka Centre and the 5-star retreat centre. We really appreciate your kind support. Thank you once again. Yes, I deserve that. No, it is actually, no, just to be honest with you, that if you go in other places in Australia, there's nothing actually like this. And that's why people come from Melbourne and Sydney and they think, oh, you know, why can't we have this in Melbourne? Why can't we have this in Sydney? And there's actually a good reason for that. This is a very, very fortunate land. Just this part of Western Australia around Perth. If actually you look at history, if you look to actually the movement of the tectonic plates and where this part of Australia came from, in the time long past, this was part of, I think they're called Gondwana land, where this particular part of Australia, if you look, it actually fits into the west part of India. We were together a long time before, and maybe in those days of previous Buddhas, when there was not this great gap of the Indian Ocean separating us, who knows, Jhana Grove may have been trodden on by Kassapa the Buddha and his great arahats. Who knows? It's a possibility, because this land was part of India. Very unlikely, but it's nice. It's a nice idea. But actually, this, we were joined with India, in the west of India, because that's where this, you can actually look at it even in the map now, it actually fits in. Next one. Ajahn, I noticed shotgun holes in the monastery street sign and also skid marks outside the gate. What's the story? Well, you know that when people do a lot of meditation, they get a bit bored sometimes. So they have a bit of fun and games, you know, but they do it mindfully. No, there's always some kids who mess around. Last night you gave a great answer to how to handle trauma and how to let go. A man at the back of the hall said something about his backyard. He didn't make sense. Was it perhaps that he has a trauma in his backside? No, he's a great guy. Just let go of everything. That's the whole thing. If you were traumatized by the answer to my question last night, you let it go. And it's a wonderful way. It's the whole idea of learning how to let things go, just, it's brilliant. Why not? And when you think you can let these things go, it's just so easy. Okay. How many of you have heard, now, a lot of you put your hands up, you know the old, the two chicken farmers story? Put your hand up, sir. It is actually most of you. Okay, I won't say it then. You want to hear it? Okay, this is actually just how we can let go of trauma. And it's a very simple story, great anecdote, but I mean it really sort of hits people because it's easy to understand and also, you know, you find out your mistakes. These little stories, you laugh at them because you can recognize, you know, you as the stupid chicken farmer. Two chicken farmers, one got up early in the morning, collected the produce of the night before, took his basket into the chicken shed, and he filled the basket full of chicken shit. You know, the little round balls of feces. And he left the eggs in the shed to rot. He brought the feces back into the house when the shit stank the whole house out. And his family thought he was very stupid, which is quite right. Chicken farmer number two went into the shed with his basket and he filled it full of eggs, which is what you're supposed to do. You know, the shit will become valuable fertilizer later, but you don't bring it into the house with you. So he brought the eggs back into the house so he can make a nice omelette for his family and sell the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. That's a smart chicken farmer. I have great fun telling that story, you know, in sort of seminars and conferences, like in the World Computer Conference. And I tell people, look, you know, the simile is very clear. You know, when you collect your past, do you collect the trauma, do you collect the shit, and bring that home with you every day? Are you shit collectors? And most people laugh because they recognise, yes, I am a shit collector. And I go back home and it's all the things wrong with the retreat, that's what I remember. You know, all the times you didn't get jhanas, that's what you remember. All the times you didn't have nimittas. But the times you do have something good happen, you leave that in the past to rot. You don't bring it into the present with you. But traumas, bad things, bad memories, that's what we collect. And when you recognize that, it's really dumb and stupid. The right thing to do is all the bad stuff you've experienced in the past, all the bad meditations, all the frustrations, all the disappointments, all the arguments, please let that rot in the past. And instead, into the present moment, bring all the wonderful memories, the wonderful times you've had. Collect the eggs. Why not? You can let go of the shit. But the problem is, most of us, we let go of the good stuff. So I would like to have a counsellor who, when he goes to you, he just asks you to remember and recall all the wonderful times you've had, and all the beautiful memories you've had. And when you start talking about your problems, I don't want to hear about those. Wouldn't it be wonderful if that's what you did when you came to the interviews with me? Instead of all the problems, and the time your meditation didn't work. Now, why didn't you try that? A different thing, and it actually works. I got into a very deep state of while doing walking meditation. Excellent. See, walking meditation actually works as well. I got into a very deep state while doing walking meditation, and myself as a young child appeared almost as real as the carpet. What was this? The mini-me is kind of still hanging around me. Is that okay? Yeah, you've got a nice sort of memory of your early life. If you really want to, just say earlier, please, and see what happens next. So it's very good. It's just, all this is that you do carry around a huge amount of memories, but, you know, in your mind, not in your brain. And the only way you can access those mind memories is when you're very still and peaceful. And then it's amazing, you just get these memories back of what it was like to be a kid, or a baby in the womb, or who you were in a previous life. I sometimes find the present moment awareness stage tricky. I feel calm and peaceful, and if there's an external silence and no distractions, there does not seem to be anything to hold me there. So before I know it, I'm watching the breath and have probably rushed through the stages. Can you please give some tips and guidance on how to hold your attention in the present moment when there's no external stimulation to reference against? Again, those three levels of recognition, familiarity, and ease. When you're at ease with the present moment, you know exactly what it is, you're so familiar with it, you're at ease with it, it stays very easily. So just recognition and be familiar with it. And you probably recognize that when that breath comes up, you are still in the present moment. Because the breath is a present breath. So you don't have to, you know, not have the breath in mind. It means that if that breath comes up and you're doing present moment awareness, the breath, the part of the breath which you're really focusing on is its presence. The fact it's here now. So there's many aspects of every object we can watch. You know, you see a person, the size, the way, sort of the features or whatever. But what you're really watching with the breath is that particular feature which is present, its nowness. So if the breath comes up, fine, let it come up. But you say to the mind, look, the most important thing is just to be now and make sure that this breath is not the breath which happened a moment ago. It's not the breath which is going to happen next, but the breath which is happening right now. So the breath, you're not really watching the breath, you're watching the nowness of the breath. That's the main object which you're watching. Easy. In the suttas it is said that lots of people, upon hearing the Buddha's sermon, became enlightened. I thought one needed jhana to become enlightened. Yeah, they had jhanas beforehand. You know, I've been to many people's house, and I've seen these photos of them sometimes receiving a degree. Have you seen photos of the, you know, kids or yourself receiving a degree, you're wearing all this really funny clothing on, with the most weird hat on top, and there's some important person's giving this scroll of paper. So I've seen many, many people receive a degree like that. So imagine, it's obvious that actually all you need to do to get a degree these days is to buy some funny clothes, turn up at these functions, and somebody actually comes and gives you this bit of paper. And of course, you know, that's not the case, because to actually to get to that point, where some big shot gives you the scroll. You've done all that work. You've done all that studies, lectures, tuitions, examinations, assignments. But no one ever takes a photo of you doing your assignment. No one ever takes a photo of you doing your examination. They just want that final piece when you just get the degree. The same way when you get married. You get the photo of your marriage, smiling each other in, again, funny clothes. I don't know why we always have to wear funny clothes to get great awards. So you wear these funny clothes. And have you ever noticed why it is? Somebody actually pointed this out. Why it is when people get married, the bride always wears white and the groom always wears dark clothes? You know why that is? Because white is a symbol of purity. So where does that leave the man? Wearing dark stuff. Yes. Anyway, so that when you get people being enlightened in the suttas, it's just the last photo, just the straw which eventually broke the camel's back. The last little piece in the jigsaw, the time when you just exchange the rings, photo. The time when you just get your degree, photo. And that's the photos which appear in the suttas. So you don't get enlightened by hearing the teachings of the Buddha. That's only part of it. You become enlightened by the Eightfold Path. That's right. Just the last little ingredient, hearing the teaching of the Buddha and all the path comes together. The Eightfold Path is the way to become enlightened. Because, look, I already gave and loaned out some of the teachings of the Buddha, many suttas. You can actually read them now. You can sit down and hear the teaching of the Buddha. Does it work for you? How many suttas have you read? Have you enlightened yet? In those days, just one sutta and you were enlightened. Look, that very famous one, the Bahya teaching. I'm now going to teach you the Bahya teaching. In the seen, there would just be the seen. In the heard, just the heard. In the sensed, just the sensed. And in the known, just be the known. Practice like that, Bahya. Did it work? No. That worked because Bahya had already done jhanas and stuff, so he's just right ready. He had the match. He just needed a tiny bit of gunpowder and bang. So that's why Eightfold Path is the only way. So don't try to see the easy way. That's why somebody once asked, what's the easy way? This is the easy way. Oh God, really? Yes, it is the easy way. Ajahn, will you get bored when you do the same chanting every morning and evening? I do. Look, it's not the chanting, it's what you do with the chanting. Remember that it's how you make use of the things you have to do in life. You can't change the world, but you can change your attitude. So you put some fun into the chanting. Now I try and do, you know, Yo So Bhagawat. Like I did the other night, give us a yo, give us a so. What does it spell? Yo So Bhagawat Allah. Whatever. So that's why it doesn't get boring, because you put energy into it, you put interest into it. So that's why, you know, life is only boring when people just allow it to be boring and they just make sort of, you know, the same old thing. They're just negative. It's just chanting. What do I want to do chanting for? You've got to do it anyway. So it's a great practice of doing something very simple and making it fun, putting energy into it. Otherwise, some people just really get depressed because nothing is really entices them. It's not that nothing entices them. They just don't put the enticement into the things they have to do. So you put your energy into it. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, you drive a hard bargain. You want 90% of the lottery winnings. And I too want 90% of the winnings. Let's compromise instead. Let's go 50-50. No. Because, you know, you've only got yourself to look after. You know, maybe you make married and a couple of kids. But look, how many people have I got to look after? I've got a whole Buddhist society with over 1,000 kids to look after. I've got a big monks monastery with even more sort of monks to look after. I've got a nun's monastery with nuns to look after. I've got a Buddhist society in Singapore to look after. I'm not one of these people, one monk and millions of disciples to look after, so I need much more than you do. Does that work? And anyway, look at it this way. If you get 10% and give me 90%, you get 10% of the money, but you get 90% of the merit. Yeah, you see. So you really win that way. I'm actually sacrificing. I only get 10% of the merit, but I get 90% of the money. So I'd sacrifice that out of compassion for you. After all, I need that big mansion where my wife and I can play hide and seek. Where I can play hide and my wife can play seek. Look, obviously whoever wrote this has never been married, because number one, if you start hiding, it will just make your wife very happy. She won't go seeking for you. She'll be so glad you're out of the way. Sometimes people say, as a monk, how do you know all of this? If I don't enter a jhana and become a stream entry in this life, what can I do to make sure I attain stream entry upon death? Give 90% of the lottery money to monastery. Okay, how can you be sure there is no certainty? But you can increase the odds. You can, there's never any certainty of these things, but at least you can actually make it just the most possible to become a stream winner on your death. How to do that? Keep your precepts. No messing around. No scallywagging. So you keep your precepts. You be generous. You can't take it with you. What was that joke? I told it in Nolamara about the rich man. And he went to sort of the priest. He's a multi-millionaire. He went to the priest and he said, look, sort of, you know, I'm going to die soon. And I've worked hard for all this money. I haven't cheated it. I made it by my own hard work, effort and skill. Surely I can take some of it with me. And the priest said, no, you can't. It's never been done. You know, everybody knows that. He said, listen, I'll do a deal. I'll give your monastery or temple $5 million if you let me take something up to heaven with me. And so the priest thought, you know, you can't just look at a deal like that and ignore it. So, he went to meditate and commune with God. And, you know, he prayed. And he got this answer. You know, he said to us, look, we really need $5 million for my church. And this guy, all he wants is to take a little bit with him. How about it? And God said, well, okay. Because, you know, your church needs something. So, $5 million, if he gives $5 million to the church, you can tell him he can take one suitcase with him up into heaven. And so the priest came back and told the guy, this is the first time this has ever happened. So if you write out that check for $5 million and it doesn't bounce, you'll be able to take one suitcase with you up into heaven. That's the best I can do. But no one else has ever had that opportunity, so you're very lucky. So the rich man had to accept that. He gave out the $5 million to the church, and you know, when it sort of was cashed, you know, that he knew he could take a suitcase. He died a few days later, but before he died, he had his suitcase and he started thinking, what can I take with me in a suitcase, which is really valuable? You know, dollars, euros, they go up, they go down. But gold. Gold is one of the best investments today, people tell me. The price always goes up. It's a safe haven investment. Is that right, Professor? Anyway, so he said, okay, I'm going to fill my suitcase up with gold. So he got all these solid gold bars, threw them in his suitcase, had it by his bed. So when he died, he appeared in the gates of heaven with his suitcase. Angels said, sorry, you can't come in here with the suitcase. So I got special permission. He said, no, you haven't. Yes, I have. So the angel SMS'd God. And he got the message back. Actually, yes, said God, a special case. This is the guy who gave 5 mil to the church. So I allowed him to take my suitcase in. So the angel was just, okay, the boss says so, so you can go in. But if you don't mind, can I just have a look what you've taken in? You know, what you put in your suitcase. And he opened up, had all these gold bars. And the angel was really surprised. Gold bars? You brought paving bricks up to heaven. No, that's heaven paved with gold. Okay. Anyway, how do you ensure you can attain stream entry upon death? Just keep your precepts, be generous, and do lots of meditation. And also just read sutras, and then you're increasing the odds. There were about 4 old songs came to my mind, half a verse in the last 3 to 4 days. Without my knowledge, there were songs I learned at 7, 8 years of age. Is this like your will is appearing at the time of death? That's an interesting question, because when you get very peaceful, sometimes old memories can come up. But a lot of times it's a bit of boredom, because the mind is searching for things which you really enjoyed from the past. But if they come up and they're old songs from 7 to 8 years of age, it's obviously you enjoyed those songs. So take the happiness, as I said this morning, from those songs, and let the songs disappear and keep the happiness. The beautiful times when you're young, when you're free, had no worries at all in the world. You're just playing around. You weren't aiming for anything. This is your playtime. Great thing about childhood is no one's asking you to do very much. Just enjoy playing around, and you don't want to achieve anything. You're just enjoying the moment. Kids are very much in the moment. So take that part of that childhood experience. The songs themselves, just drop those, but take the other part and keep that in your meditation. It might work. Dear Ajahn, why do some arahats have psychic abilities and some don't? Ah, that's interesting. Because sometimes people, what do you want psychic abilities for anyway? I said the other day, flying through the air. Imagine I did fly to Sri Lanka tomorrow. I'll go to Sri Lanka tomorrow. If I arrived there, it'd be a hell of a lot of sort of difficulty with the customs immigration. Because you've got to actually, on the form it says, you know, which airline, or which train, or which boat did you come? You say neither of those. You know, you don't have actually, you'd think in a place like Sri Lanka, being a Buddhist country, you would have, you know, another sort of box to tick psychic powers. So maybe, you know, have rocks like that. You know, which airline? Buddha Air. So, but anyway, why some do, some don't. You know, a lot of it is because there's maybe sometimes how quick you get enlightened. If you get the enlightened very quickly, you just go very smoothly, you know, through it. You really let go a lot. And basically, you're just so peaceful and still, you haven't really sort of got the power to get the psychic powers. But sometimes people do it sort of very slowly. You build up enormous amounts of power and energy. And that's, sometimes if you guys get into some deep meditation, sometimes you can feel the power of the mind. And you know, don't have any doubts anymore that psychic powers exist. You can actually feel that energy, that power. It's just learning how to use it and employ it. So that you build up lots of power during the meditation and during your practice. In other words, it takes you a long time. I think a long time people, they usually get psychic powers, but you get it very quickly, maybe not. That's only my theory anyway. When or where can we celebrate Upeka's ordination? Upeka, where is she? Up there. 6th of March? 6th of March. Is that official? That's what they told me. Yeah. Sunday the 6th of March, she'll become Samaneri. Usually what happens, we wait until, you know, they wear white, until the whites get so dirty and grubby they can't be washed anymore, and then we give them brown. So it's getting a bit grubby. Same with our two Anangarikas at the back over there, Peter and Nicholas. When it gets dirty, they... Anyway. Okay. Uh-oh. Okay, I've got to read all these out. Ajahn, the nuns' monastery should say sorry for the last 10 years. Sorry to the women who want to ordain and were refused. Sorry to the women who wanted to stay at the monastery and were refused. Sorry to the women and men who gave dana and were abused. A sorry announcement should be made on Friday night, taught by a nun. A sorry letter should be sent to all BSAWA members. A sorry notice should be put on the notice board at Nolamara. A sorry article should be written in the United Times. Saying so would heal wounds and reconnect the community, and a new era then can begin. Please pass this suggestion to the nuns and committee. Well, I don't know if that's a really good idea for self. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point, isn't it? But, you know, sometimes that, as a Buddhist, there's sometimes that we can learn from things. The most important thing is we have this AFL code: acknowledge, forgive, and learn. And sometimes that's all we really need to do, to acknowledge, you know, that when we first start something, it's very, very difficult. Mistakes are sometimes made. Acknowledge. In other words, say what actually happened, if anything happened. Say the other side of the story as well. Because, I mean, there's always two sides to a story. And there's always, the two bad bricks in the wall and the 998 good bricks or whatever. So acknowledge the truth of the matter. And then the nice thing is just to forgive. Because, you know, people are in difficult situations, and sometimes they say, well, if you were in that situation, what would you have done? Would you be any better? And then to learn, to make sure you have strategies in place that doesn't happen in the future. And I think that's all we really need to do. I know that, you know, Kevin Rudd did that sorry day. And it helped a little bit, but it's not really enough. There's much more needs to be done, and sometimes sorry is not enough. So maybe there's another way. Because I think sorry is a bit too much like lingering in the past with negativity. And I don't think it really works. I don't know. Other people might be wiser than me in that one. But anyway, thank you, Ajahn. I enjoyed every moment of this retreat. Metta. You must be in denial. There's no way you can enjoy every moment of a retreat. There must be some moments when you get really fed up. Some moments when you think, why can't he stop talking so I can go to bed? There must be some moments. But what you really mean by that is you had a pretty good time, and that's good enough. Does the Buddhist text mention the Lord Buddha visited his mother in Tusita Deva realm and taught her the Abhidharma? Possibly it's difficult for everyone to understand, therefore it's not much talked about. Actually, this is one of the other arguments that it mentioned in that, in this Abhidharma commentary, the Buddha visited the Tawatingsa heaven to teach his mother. But the sutra said his mother was actually in the Tusita realm. So they don't even get that right. So, you know, they say that he taught in one realm, he taught his mother, but the other sutra says his mother wasn't in that realm anyway. It was in another realm. And it says that he taught, according to the commentary, it says, taught the Abhidhamma to the mother in 3 months. And it's one of those books, was it the Pugala Panyati or whatever it's called. And if actually you read that, it's so heavily abbreviated. They said that the Buddha taught the whole thing. And somebody's actually worked it out. I think it was Venerable Anallio. That to speak the whole of that one Abhidharma book at a normal rate will take about 200 years. It's that big. And so for the Buddha to have recited it in 3 months, it would have to be so quick that no one could ever really understand it. It's actually interesting that, you know, Western monks actually do that. They have a look at sort of the logic behind it, and know it's actually impossible. And anyway, one of the Abhidharma books is called the Katawatu, which is like the points of controversy. And they talk specifically about a monk who was alive a couple of hundred years after the time of the Buddha. And everyone knows he was alive at that time. And these controversies hadn't appeared yet. Everybody knows. So how could the Buddha have taught that when it hadn't happened yet? It was absolutely impossible. So, I mean, the thing is, they have all these things. It's sometimes, you know, okay, sometimes like some Thai monks who say, there are no bhikkhunis anymore. There's no bhikkhunis in Thailand. And they're just right in front of you. Now, what is that? There are no bhikkhunis anymore. So what are you? So sometimes the theory, what people want to understand, is so strong, they don't actually see the obvious facts. So if you look at the facts of the Abhidhamma, it's very, very clear. I wouldn't say this if I wasn't on really, really solid ground. It's a belief the Buddha did this, but it just doesn't wash. It doesn't have any logical foundations. And as a Buddhist, now, that one of the important parts of Buddhists, we should question. And if it's not logical, it's got no foundations, if it is mythical, we should accept that. And we should always question, follow the evidence. Dear Ajahn, I didn't rejoice in my friend's best practice. Instead, I felt jealous of her. For such a case that I received bad karma. Yeah, I mean, jealous of somebody else's, you know, good practice. So they've had a limiter, or they've got jhanas, or they've got some enlightenment. And you think, that sucks. I've been coming here to this monastery for so many years. I've just been serving the monks and the nuns with food all this time. I've committed so much, I've given so much money, they've never given a dime into that donation box, and they don't keep precepts, and this is their first retreat, they get jhana, unfair. No, you can't sort of judge other people. So it's bad karma, because you're developing negativity, and also you're stopping yourself having this wonderful opportunity for joy. What a wonderful thing it is that this is still possible in these days for people to get jhanas and get enlightenment and stuff like that. Isn't that amazing? And it should really be inspirational. It's amazing, wonderful. If you can do it, then obviously I can do it. You got it first, but I'll get it later. So that's what we call mudita, sympathetic joy. And so when somebody else does something good and they succeed, what you should do is think, wow, what a wonderful thing. And thereby, you get some of the action. Dear Ajahn, being a lay person, not giving up of your possessions and desires, is it possible to be enlightened? So you want to be enlightened and have all your possessions at the same time. That's called having your cake and eating it, isn't it? You know where that saying came from? That came from actually the North Indians, in Canada. Because, one day there was these two Canadians in their little boat, and it's very cold up in the north of Canada, and so they decided to, the only thing they could do to warm themselves is to light a fire in their boat. But the boat was just made of wood with like animal hide. So as soon as they lit the boat, it burned a hole in the bottom and sank. So that's where you got the saying from. You can't have your kayak and heat it. Surely you saw that one coming. These days, young children play computer games, play static games with killings and wars continuously if we do not ask them to do something else until midnight. I think when they train their minds to focus on killing one point for a long time, their minds are also training to look at one thing rather than looking at the big picture of anything. If we ask them to do something else, they are not happy. Can you please give your opinions and advice on this? I know that sometimes some people actually develop Buddhist video games. I think, if you keep the precepts, then you slay Mara or something. I don't know what it is. Or you slay defilements or something. And so they try to get this the kids like the computer games and try and employ that to make it something beautiful. So instead of slaying the enemy, you forgive them and then you really win more points. So there's all sorts of stuff which can be done. And a few people are trying to get sort of Buddhist computer games, or not just Buddhist computer games, more sort of ethical computer games, which is encouraging really good qualities instead of killing. So you get more points, and the more people you forgive, or the more times you're kind, rather than more times you kill things. So it is a possible thing to do. But again, I don't know many, many people. I didn't have computer games when I was young, but I used to read these comics, war comics and stuff. And I ended up as a Buddhist monk. So it didn't really harm me that much. I used to play sort of cops and robbers and cowboys and Indians with my friends. And, used to shoot your friends, you're dead, no I'm not, yes you're dead, bang, bang. Ooh, ooh. So I used to play those games, it didn't really affect me. So apparently, most psychologists say that those computer games don't really affect the kids very much, but there's always a few it does affect, and they're the dangerous ones. So most kids are okay. A friend diagnosed bipolar with schizophrenia, has bouts of depressions, goes on uncontrolled spending spree, drives her car aimlessly. Imagine she's being attacked by seen unseen beings. We don't know because we can't make sense of it. She's on medication, makes her mostly drowsy and weak, goes for counselling, but she relapses so often. When especially bad, we take her to the monks who chant for her, calms her down, but only temporary. Should she be encouraged to meditate? What suitable? Breath, vipassana, metta. Okay, yeah, it can. People with schizophrenia or bipolar, they can actually learn how to meditate, but you've got to be very, very gentle. Vipassana stuff is far too tough, and it just screws their mind up even more. Gentle things like metta meditation, that can work, that can actually do some really great things. It can be done, but you have to be very kind, very slow, and not demanding. One of the nice moments I had when I was in Singapore a few years ago was giving an address, a keynote, at the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore's, that's 50th or 60th anniversary or something. And one of the doctors was very impressed with my talk and invited me back to his unit in the hospital to do a blessing. He said, I'm a Christian, but I like your talk. Please bless my ward. Do some chanting. And on the way there, I said, how do you treat your schizophrenia patients? It's a schizophrenia ward. He said, I don't treat the schizophrenia. I treat the other part of the patient. I treat the times when they're not schizophrenic. And I thought, wow, amazing. That fellow's understood. And as he said, exactly what he said in the talk. And I thought, it's incredibly brilliant. Understanding the nature of the mind. If you treat the schizophrenia, they're schizophrenic. They know they're schizophrenic. It encourages it. If you treat the other part of them when they're not schizophrenic, it totally changes the ball game. It encourages they pay more attention. You're acknowledging the other part of them. And that actually tends to grow more. This is having amazing results. I thought it was brilliant. Brilliant psychology, psychiatry. So if you have someone with schizophrenia, they're not always showing schizophrenic behavior. Don't forget the other part of them. Treat that too. And as for goes on uncontrolled spending sprees, that's where you need to give them plastic surgery. You know what plastic surgery is? About the husband who gave his wife plastic surgery? Cut up her credit cards. That's called plastic surgery. Cut the credit cards. But, look, taking that to the monks is a pretty much of a waste of time. So you can give a bit of inspiration, but, you know, you need sort of medication, not so much inspiration. Yeah. Yeah. Excellent, yeah. Very good. Yeah, anything you know about sort of what to do in such situations? Talk to Lincoln. Dear Ajahn, Angulimala Sutta, I think the first verse, since I have ordained in this holy life, I think it says since I've been born into this holy life. Since I was born, I think. What is it now? Jati Ajata. Yeah, since I was born into this life. Into the Aryan life. So not ordained, but ordained, not born. Anguli made asseveration of truth before he was enlightened, not after. No, it was actually after he became enlightened he made that asseveration. By the way, I heard it was, so I got Helmut Becker, I'm not sure spelling of author wrote about this, can check list of access to insight. I'm pretty sure that that was actually said after his attainment of enlightenment. By the way, I heard a story of the Angulimala Sutta working in modern times in Taiping. One is the mother with unborn child, fetus didn't turn head down, was when about to be born. Mother was very worried because of a near due date. She went to one of the Buddhist monasteries, Taiping, where the monks chanted the paritta. Soon after the fetus turned downwards to right position, mother gave birth to a child safely. People, you may want to check whether this really happened with the SBS monks, but you want to see whether there was a connection there. Did the chanting actually make the child turn upside down, or was it turning upside down for other reasons? So if you really want to find out whether chanting works, you've got to be very scientific about this. So not just one occasion. One doesn't prove anything. It might have happened anyway. There's this old story of the monks who were chanting in the monastery to keep the tigers away in Australia. And someone said, but there are no tigers in Australia. And the monk said, see, the chanting works. Be very careful. What's this one? Dear Rajan, this is an opportunity to pay gratitude to JGMC. Option one, get a tax receipt from $100 advance. Taxman will give $30 back. Will they? Depends on what tax bracket you are in. Because over here, you pay some money. If it goes into the building fund, then you can claim that back on the tax. You don't get anything back. You just, your income goes down $100. That's how it works over here in Australia. Well, add $100 to the advance $200 and taxman will give back whatever, I don't know. JGMC gets, this must be written by an accountant. Option three, $200 per tax, say $250. Tax will find $75 back. The JGMC will get $250. My question is, are we breaking any precepts? If not, deferred option is option number three. I don't know about that. Just give the money anyway. You don't have to think so much. This round retreat is my fruitful retreat. I value your teachings, this centre, very, very much. With wishing you long life, healthy and happy always. So another satisfied customer. Ajahn, some meditators, when they meditate, they purify themselves of negative deviant forces, such as Naga force, deviant Tibetan practice force, Kuan Yin force. Some of these meditators are visibly affected. Bouts of vomiting and intense retching. What are your views on this? The food must be terrible if you have intense vomiting and retching. The food here is so good. How can you vomit it? How can you retch? So I think that must be something to do with the kitchen. So no, you don't purify things. There's so much superstition in Buddhism. Okay, there's some things which are real. There are such things as psychic powers. I've seen some things, but a lot of this is actually superstition. So again, some of that superstitious stuff. Deviant forces inside of you. There's no such thing as deviant force inside. Yeah, there's sickness inside of you. Sometimes I've said to many people, you start twitching or something. That's just a balance of the energy. But vomiting and retching, if anybody vomits and retches here, I take you to see a doctor. It's not the purging of deviant forces. There's something wrong with you. You're sick. So, okay, I'm Western. I've seen some really weird and strange things in my life. But sometimes superstition goes a bit too far. And if somebody's retching like that, don't think, oh, they're just going through some purification. Go to see the doctor. You know, you're in sick. Otherwise, Buddhism gets a very strange reputation of being just mumbo-jumbo and magic. And sometimes people like mumbo-jumbo and magic. It works until you get so sick. And somebody say, oh, just don't take them to the doctor. Take your child to the monks and they'll chant for you. They'll die. And then how do you feel? There was this classic case of this lady some years ago came to ask for some chanting from the monks at Nolamara because she was going to have her exams the next day at university. We never saw her again. Why? Because she failed. But we saw her friends, and a friend said, that lady's going around criticizing you monks. The monks at Nolamara Temple are no good. Don't feed them, they're hopeless. Why? Because they can't chant. I failed. And he said, it's not the monk's fault. This girl had done no work, gone to parties all the time, never gone to lectures. No wonder she failed. So superstition sometimes is very dangerous. Ajahn Brahm, last retreat I did in January in Thailand, they told us not to sleep for the last 3 nights. What do you think of this practice? Gee, I left there feeling terrible. You should sue them. Could it be part of the reason I've been sleeping so much on this retreat? Look, that's controlling you. That's what they do in Guantanamo Bay. It's called sleep deprivation. Next time they'll be waterboarding you at that retreat. So look, that's not the way to meditate. There are times when actually you do get energy and you don't feel like sleeping. If you don't feel like sleeping, you don't have to. You can sleep later on. But if it's forced on you and said you mustn't sleep for 3 days, that is psychologically dangerous. That is abusive. If you tried that here in Australia, you could go to jail for things like that. So it has to come naturally. Don't force it. You just get tense and sometimes people screw their minds up. Thank you for a wonderful retreat. Thank you, Bianca. Thank you for those volunteers who offered dana. May you all be well and happy. We're trying our best to be well and happy. When you are reborn, what is the state of your mindfulness and awareness you developed in this previous life? Are you talking about me or whatever? When are you born? What is the state of your mindfulness awareness if you developed in the previous life? Okay, I know what you're talking about now. It means your inclinations carry on with you. So if you know you're inclined towards being a Buddhist, you're likely to find Buddhism again, because that's your inclination. And if you're inclined, you know, to like being aggressive, you'll be aggressive. Those inclinations, those character traits, that's what really carries on. Your memories don't really carry on that much, but your character traits do. So for example, suppose I got reborn in the next life, I'd tell stupid jokes again. So that's how you can recognise that, you know, if I get reborn again, this young person tells you stupid jokes. Oh, that's Ajahn Brahm, oh God. You have to put up with him another lifetime. I have a tendency towards anger and so on. Sometimes I ruminate on the same old unpleasant thoughts like a soap opera addict. I know you've explored similar themes, but any further advice on how to be free? Feels like I'm far gone, but the other way. Well, again, that's a story about the chicken farmers and collecting the eggs or collecting the shit. So you have to do a lot of work on collecting eggs. And that way you just, instead of seeing the anger and sorrow, the negative of your past, you see the beauty of your past. So that's number one. If you're going to look at the past, just pick up the eggs. But even better than that, don't even worry about the past. Anger, sorrow, it's all gone. You can't do anything about it. Why are you in that prison? So see if you can let it go. It does pass. This too will pass. And eventually it does pass. And if you can encourage yourself to let go of the past and understand it's allowable, it's good, it's the best thing you can do for yourself and all other people, then you just do it. You don't have to remember the past in that way. Let it all go. And you can be totally free in the present. Living in the present moment, again. A teacher of English as a foreign language was teaching her students the different tenses and gave this sentence. To change the past tense, he gives her a present. Quick as a flash, a star pupil piped up, he gives her a past. So that's a joke, I suppose. Living in the present moment, he gives her a present, he gave her a past. So sometimes you don't actually give someone a past, you take up the past. So every present moment eventually becomes a past moment. But you get so many moments, if you keep on collecting the past, it becomes just so much you have to remember, so many things you have to collect. It's like all of these questions over here, I can't fit them on my chair anymore. And that reminded me of when I was in Australia, when I first went to see my mother. This is my mother's mantel shelf simile. So I was going to see my mum, and you know, people over here, you've got to take something off to see your mum. What does your mum want? And so I said, oh, no, something Australian. Little stuffed kangaroo, like one of these cuddly toys. So someone brought me a nice little kangaroo, and I gave it to my mum. She loved it. You know, it's nice and soft, and just it looks nice. It's Australian. So I said, oh, you know, when I see that, I can remember my son over in Australia. So she put it on the shelf. I call the mantel shelf in the front room with all the other sort of knick-knacks on. So the next time I went to see her, I thought, what can I get her this time? Koala bear. You know, a nice little toy koala bear, nice and soft and fluffy again. So I got the koala bear. And so she put that on the mantel shelf next to the kangaroo. Now, there's even 4 or 5 years space between them, but, you know, the kangaroo was still there. So the next time I went there, I managed to get a little platypus. And that went up there on the mantel shelf. The next time, a kookaburra. And the last time, I got a wombat. Now, by the time I got the wombat, that mantel shelf was so full that when my mother, still the kangaroo, the koala, the kookaburra and the platypus, that was still up there. And when she tried to put the wombat on, it didn't fit. And things started to fall off. And I said, no, just throw some of those old ones away. You've had that kangaroo for years. Throw it away. I said, oh, no. It's just so nice. It reminds you of me, of you. They said, you can't keep anything up there. They said, oh, no, I'll manage. And she managed to eventually balance everything precariously. Fit them on. And I thought, my goodness, isn't that just like people with their mental breakdowns? You keep so much of the past that eventually it just doesn't fit inside your brain anymore. And something falls out. That's called mental breakdown. So I said, that's not the way to live. If that was me, you know, when I received the kangaroo, I put that through everything else away and just keep the kangaroo on there. And when somebody comes and brings me like the koala, I'll throw the kangaroo away, you know, give it to some charity, they can make use of it, pass it on. And now I have my koala. Oh, isn't that nice? And after the koala's been there a few years, I'll throw that away and have another kookaburra, and then sort of the platypus. And that when the big wombat comes, I'll throw the platypus away and just keep the wombat. One thing at a time, then you can really appreciate it then. So why do we keep collecting the past? And photographs. Why the heck are you taking photographs? Just collecting the past. Do you really need photographs? That's actually a bad practice, because what that is actually trying to capture the past. My photograph story. I told this to the Singaporeans. I said, when I was about 21, I forget exactly what time now, I went over to pilgrimage to India. I'm already a Buddhist. And I thought, this is what Buddhists do. Go on pilgrimage to India. Find out this place is where the Buddha lived. So I went overland from London, because I was very, very poor. And managed to sort of get into India. And one of the other things I wanted to do, I always wanted to see the Himalaya Mountains. Because they're supposed to be breathtakingly beautiful. But, you know, being poor, being stupid, I never did any research. So when I arrived in India, you know, it was the summertime in the UK, so it was monsoon season in India. Clouds everywhere. And after just a couple of weeks, I realized I wasn't going to see any Himalayas. It was the wrong season. You're supposed to go, like, maybe December, January, February. That's when you see the Himalayas. So I just gave up that idea. But one day, after trying to find these holy sites, I was up in Kathmandu. And, you know, the word was around, actually, you can go up to the Tibetan border. You know, on the post van, there's a postal service from Kathmandu once a week. And you're not supposed to do this, but, you know, you pay the driver a few, you know, rupees. And he puts you in the back of the van, and you get this nice trip, you know, way up to the north of Nepal. And so, the whole day, it was a really great adventure. So I went up there. And you know, somewhere they stopped for lunch or a cup of tea. And there was a couple of Americans in the bus with me, who was also on the same deal. And as the guy was having a cup of tea, there was a little hill, and we just said, oh, let's just walk up the hill and see what's up there. So it was only about sort of 10 minutes to the top of the hill. And as we got to the top of the hill, the clouds parted. You could see the whole of the Himalayas. It was just that one moment during the rainy season. So you know what I did? I ran down to the car, because I left my camera in the car. I ran all the way down and ran up. The two Americans were just sitting up there, and no joke, as soon as I got up, the clouds parted. As clouds closed in, rather. And I couldn't even take a camera. And the two men said, where did you go? It was amazingly beautiful. We had a wonderful time watching this. I said, I went to get my camera. So that really told me how stupid these cameras are. When you take cameras, you're missing what's actually happening now while you're trying to capture it for posterity. You can't capture anything. You know, this moment, as soon as it's here, it's gone. So all this photograph business, it's not Buddhist, is it? What do you want the photograph for anyway? What's its purpose? Family who are Buddhist. Ah, don't suck up to those heretics. But anyway, okay, maybe one photo just to sort of prove you were here to your boss or whatever. But you know, all these photographs, you know, I never actually keep photographs. People give me photographs, I burn them or throw them away straight away. So don't give me any photographs. If I want to see me, I just look in the mirror. So anyway, because I know that, because you got a note over here, Bianca said, you want to do photographs tomorrow. So anyone who wants a photograph, especially the group photograph, we'll meet at 1 a.m. tomorrow morning in front of this thing. No, some stupid person would do that. That's only a joke, okay. So if you really do want photographs, keep it very quick and simple. After the Dhamma talk tomorrow morning, so 9 o'clock. That's the only chance you have, because now my program tomorrow is after lunch, you know, 12:30 to 1:30, we do the last meditation and the Metta Sutta, sharing of merits. And at, what is it? At 1:30, I have to leave. I've got a plane to catch at 4 o'clock. So please don't come along and say, oh, just one more photo. Just one more question. Just one more, please. That happened to me almost once in Singapore. I was outside there, and you know, they were saying, another photograph, just one more, just one more. And by the time I got to the plane, they were calling out my name. Well, Mr. Brahma won, so come quick. There's all these photographs. And look, I'm not a model. Neither are you. Anyway, I am very interested in the business of letting go. Which of the Buddha suttas best address the key topic? Thank you again for your patient endurance, generosity and kindness you have offered on this wonderful meditation retreat. One of the best suttas on letting go is the very first sutta, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, in the third noble truth. It teaches the four ways of letting go. So sometimes, you know, people don't actually see that, and because I'm a monk and you know the path, you see that. Four ways of letting go. Number one, chaga, generosity. That's why we don't have donation boxes in monasteries, we have letting go boxes. So let go. So, but it's not money. Next meditation you do, give. Don't try and get something. Because a lot of times people meditate, they want nimittas, they want jhana. That's not giving. It's wanting. So giving is the opposite. I'm just going to give this hour to meditation. I just don't want anything back in return. I'm going to give $20 in the donation box. I don't want tax receipt. I'm giving, not wanting anything back from me. Not wanting any good karma or merits. I'm just giving it for the sake of giving. That's called letting go, chaga. I mentioned one of the other ones, which is mutti. That's being so content, you're just happy to be here. So you're free. You don't want to go anywhere other than being here, right now, in this moment. Total contentment, that's the other way of letting go. Third way of letting go is throwing things away. Not trying to accumulate more attainments, but see how much you can lose, how much you can let go, how much you can throw away. And lastly, this anālaya, which is what we call the Teflon mind. So nothing sticks. The past doesn't stick to you. You just don't keep anything. You have this experience, you have this retreat, and you let it go totally, completely. So you don't take anything back home with you. Nothing back home. You let go. Good memories, bad memories, everything. Is let go in this retreat. That's called letting go. The four ways of letting go. Check it out. It's in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Sometimes people think they saw the Dhamma, but they haven't really. How would one know if they see it? And why would someone think they saw it if they haven't? I just wishful thinking. That's what it is. You know, sometimes you have to go back. And then maybe, if not even before you go back, maybe your partner or best friend are here on this retreat. And they say, what have you done in the last 9 days? You spent all this money, all this time, what have you done? You think, if I say I haven't seen anything, well, I've sort of seen the Dhamma. Because just this pride of having to do something, achieve something, you know, where was a light, what was a nimitta? No, was it somebody taking the photographs? It wasn't a nimitta. But we want to have something because of pride so much. It's pride makes us say we see the Dhamma, but we haven't. And so how do you know you have seen the Dhamma? Because you don't get angry, you don't get upset, you don't want very much in life. You know, you just don't go around telling other people, I've seen the Dhamma. You see a person with a t-shirt, I've seen the Dhamma, written on the top side of their t-shirt. No, they haven't seen the Dhamma at all. So, lack of pride. Oops. You know. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Why don't I turn this in half? There must be some sort of Freudian slip there. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for a wonderful retreat. Yes, I agree with that one. What is the difference between knowledge of Dhamma and vision of Dhamma? Is seeing the Dhamma simply knowing cessation is possible? Actually, that's a very good definition of seeing the Dhamma, seeing that cessation of everything is possible. The whole caboodle. It's very easy to see that something sees. You know your body's going to go. But do you know your will is going to go? Your mind is going to go. As I said in the beginning of this retreat, you've come here to lose your mind. People think losing your mind is a terrible thing, but that's what we do. As monks, this is spiritual suicide, the path of Buddhism. That's why I'm really into suicide. It's called parinibbana. Everything stops. Poof, gone. So the difference between knowledge of Dhamma and vision of Dhamma, it's usually called knowledge of vision. Once it's jnana dasana, yeah, I think that's used the word. Sometimes that, I've often mentioned this in Pali, when you actually see the translations of Pali, they use 3, 4, 5, 6 words, where in English where they'd only use one. So there's lots of repetitions of knowledge, vision, light appearing, whatever, but really it all means the same thing. So when you understand Pali, sometimes a translation, they think, oh, there must be some nuance here, difference of meaning. There never was meant to be one. So knowledge and vision. Imagine a long time ago, a monk told us, I had told us, and had the Buddha has told about the suicide, well, the concept, what was it? A long time ago, a monk told us that the Buddha has told about the suicide and what are the consequences if a bhikkhu committed suicide, and it is in one of the suttas. No, there's nothing there at all about that. Where there is the case of, it's in the Paratika rules, a monk was really fed up, he wasn't enlightened, decided to commit suicide. So he jumped off the cliff. And what happened? It happened to be a man at the bottom of the cliff, and so this monk landed on top of him. The monk was okay, but he killed the man. And so they asked the Buddha, what about that? And all the Buddha said is, you shouldn't jump off cliffs. And he never actually said you should never commit suicide. And that's actually an important part there. The Buddha had, this was the opportunity. If suicide was to be banned, you would have expected it to be there, and it wasn't there at all. And there was the cases of enlightened monks committing suicide, or the great one, Chana, who wasn't enlightened, thought he was enlightened, cut his own throat, and realized he wasn't enlightened. But from the time when he cut his throat to the time when he died, he managed to sort of break through and become enlightened. That was a very dangerous thing, but he managed to do it in the end. Or there's the other, what's her name? I think it was called Wajira, the nun, the bhikkhuni. Now, I tell this story with a bit of trepidation, because I don't recommend you to try this. There was a nun who'd been a nun, I think, for about 7 years, or maybe longer, I forget now. And she hadn't got any peace at all in her meditation. No peace, no present moment awareness. It was just struggle, struggle, struggle all the time. And after so much years of practice, she realized, you don't get it after such a long time. What's the point? So she realized she had no happiness as a nun. But she did not want to go to return to the lay life. Because a woman had to find a husband somewhere, that's the only thing you could do. And that's when she said, no, I don't want to return to the three crooked things. And the three crooked things was like a term, used in early Buddhism, which meant, it was a symbol of like domestic life. And they used to call the three crooked things, if you became a nun and you left her home, you abandoned the three crooked things. And they explained the three crooked things as this. The first crooked thing was the broom, which you used to sweep the house out with. And it was the sweeping. And the second crooked thing was the ladle, which was a symbol for cooking. And the third crooked thing she gave up when she became a nun was the husband. They used to call that the three crooked things. Even in those days, they had a great sort of sense of humour. The three crooked things. All to do with housework. So she said, I'm not going to go back to the three crooked things, and I can't stay as a nun, so there's only one thing for me to do, commit suicide. So she did it in a very common way. She got a rope. She went into the forest. She tied one end to a tree, the other one round to her neck. And just as she was about to jump off, because she was about to let go, she got an enlightenment experience. I was cutting a bit fine. I don't recommend that for you. So she told about that in her story of enlightenment. She was so frustrated, she totally let go. And one of the ways of letting go, obviously, she thought, I'm going to kill myself. And that degree of letting go was enough for her to renounce, to stop. And amazing, her mind opened up. She saw the Dhamma. Don't try that. A much better method of letting go is, you know, many of you heard this before, is called the Ananda method. Because the Ananda method of enlightenment is one of the most popular in Australia today. And the United States, and Malaysia, and Singapore, Sri Lanka. Because, you know the story, Ananda, the disciple of the Buddha for about, I don't know how many years, 25 years I think, and being with a great teacher himself. And, you know, he'd be sitting here listening to the Buddha teach, you know, like Chunda is doing now. And, but for Ananda, that all these people getting enlightened, lay people coming up, monks coming up, and they're getting enlightened psychic powers, but poor old Ananda, for 25 years he was sitting there getting nothing. He was a screen winner, but nothing more. And imagine how just frustrating that would be. If he had any jealousy in him, he'd be terribly jealous. Now everyone else gets enlightened for 25 years, you know, it's just like you're sitting here as caretaker of Jhana Grove, all these people come in, they get enlightened, 25 years, you end up just doing all the cooking and the cleaning, you never get enlightened at all. That really would suck, wouldn't it, Janya? But anyway, and then the Buddha died. And Ananda thought, just, what hope is there for me? I've been 25 years with the Buddha, the greatest of teachers, and I'm still not enlightened. What hope is there for me? Well, he actually pretty much gave up. But then the monks decided to have this big convocation. 500 monks were invited to recite all of the teachings of the Buddha they could remember, and the rules as well. And because Ananda had been with the Buddha for the last 25 years, that he knew so many of these teachings. So they had to invite him, even though he was the only one who wasn't enlightened. 499 arahats, and he was the one which wasn't. Imagine if that was you, what would you do? You'd be so embarrassed, like Ananda, he just meditated all night. He went for broke. He tried, just out of, you know, ego, I suppose. You know, wanting to be just another arahat, so he could deserve to go in this great meeting with 499 other arahats. When the dawn came up, he was as stupid as when he started. Got him nowhere. You know what it's like sometimes? You put forth effort in this retreat. Some of you sort of have made no progress at all. Probably even worse in meditation when you came here. And that was Ananda, all night. So he thought, what's the point? So he went to just take a nap before the meeting started. And before his head hit the pillow, he became totally enlightened. With psychic powers too. So many psychic powers that decided that maybe people wouldn't believe that he was an arahat. So he waited till 5 or 10 minutes after the meeting started. He deliberately arrived late. The door was locked, so he came in the keyhole. He went through the keyhole and entered the meeting that way, which was pretty cool. And they realized that he got it. And how did he do that? He just put his head on the pillow. So you try that tonight. And the reason he did that, because he just let go of all the striving. He'd been striving all night, and he decided, no, I'm going to stop striving. And that's when he became enlightened. You get the point? Can we get a CD of your talks, this retreat, please? Yeah, they're already done. Even the last talk, which I haven't given yet, which is tomorrow. It's already got its label on it. In the Samadhi Sutra, the nutriment is nutriment for what? The nutriment for the body. And there's four nutriments for the body, which, you know, keep your own body going on, and which is nutriment for bodies to get born anyway. And what are those four nutriments? The first one is fish and chips. Or whatever other food you like. Rice and curry, noodles, whatever else you like. That is, you know, the food nutriment. The second nutriment is, as I said, the contact. In other words, sensory experience, sensory contact. If you don't have any sensory contact, you just die. Now that keeps the consciousness, body consciousness, going. Which I always think, there must be some sort of experiments when people have been born deaf and maybe blind. How do they really live? If they die, why do they die? If they've got so many of the senses which are turned off, then you do die. Because contact, sensory contact, is important for keeping people going. Which is also why if you've got a relation who's in a coma and you really want them to come out of that coma, stimulate their five senses. Talk to them. Touch them. Stroke them. Stimulate their senses. Because without that contact, they just die. And next one is volition, will. That keeps you going. As I said, the will to live. Take away the will to live and you die. And the last one is consciousness itself. That keeps the body going. So those are the four nutriments. Consciousness, will, sense contact and food. What happens when one sees the Dharma? Can one know if it's the first time, if one saw it in previous lives, or is it the same experience? What is the experience like? How can one know? Okay, when you see the Dhamma, first of all, you know, you're so stupid. How come I didn't see that before? The Buddha's been telling me about that for such a long time. There's no one in here. There's no consciousness. There's no original mind. There's no cosmic consciousness. There's no God. There's no soul. There's no self. There's nothing there. So it's amazing to me why some people always want to cling on to some place of self, like, you know, in Hinduism, the Paramatman, the greater self. Yeah, your original self is nothing, but you merge like a drop of water in the great ocean. That's the Hindu idea, like a great ocean, and you're just part, now you're together again. No, in Buddhism, even a drop of water just evaporates and gone. There's nothing there to begin with. So this is like the Buddhist idea that everything ceases. Nothing left at all, okay? And sometimes, you know, people, oh, can I keep a little bit just for me? No. So that's when you see the Dharma. You see, you know, everything is suffering, a whole lot. And that's its very nature. So it's not up to you. You haven't made any mistakes that, you know, you have frustration and suffering in life. That's the nature of this existence. Sometimes you think it's our fault. If we're wise enough, smart enough, rich enough, we can avoid suffering. Unfortunately, birth is suffering. Once you're born, you're stuffed. So the other thing to do is make sure you're not born again in any realm. So you know that's anicca, that things are liable to cease. Just because they're here now doesn't mean they're always going to be here. Everything, even the sun, this great universe, has got a time limit on it. An expiry date. Please use by such and such a time, because your mind is going to expire. That's actually when you see the Dhamma, you actually see just there's nothing left. And how do you know if it's the first time you saw it in previous lives? Sometimes you can remember your previous lives, you know, oh, here we go again. Because if you're a streamliner and you see the Dhamma in this life, what happens in your next life? Are you born a special being? And so as soon as you come out of your mother's womb, you know, you go Bhutan, Dhammang, Sangang, Saranagachami. That you know the Four Noble Truths straight away in grade one, you teach the teacher about, you know, dependent origination. And of course not. So what happens is that in your, say you're streamlining in this life, in your next life, you're a good person, you're inclined towards Dhamma, towards meditation. You have to re-experience that same achievement which made you a streamliner. You see the Dhamma again. You have to, no other way. It's been your inclination. Two more questions to go. 9:30. Buddha got enlightened through Anapanasati, and then Gaudiya got enlightened quick. Didn't they have time for Eightfold Path? What's the essence of it? How to do it quickly? They did do the Eightfold Path. The Buddha kept his precepts. But where did he get his... He had the jhanas. Where did he get his wisdom from? Did the Buddha figure it all out for himself? Or did the Buddha have a teacher? Sometimes the normal way is to say, no, the Buddha figured it out all by himself. But contemplate this. I already mentioned earlier on this retreat, in the Gatikara Sutta, the Buddha was a monk under Kashyapa the Buddha in a previous life, and that's not that long ago. According to all the accounts of the Buddha's enlightenment, he got into the four jhanas, first watch of the night. The second watch of the night, he remembered his past lives. This was before he penetrated the Four Noble Truths, okay? He remembered his past lives. And surely he would have remembered one of the most prominent past lives when he was a disciple of the Buddha. When you remember past lives, you don't just remember, oh, I was, you know, this Jotipana, a monk with the Buddha. you'd have remembered what the Buddha taught you. So Siddhartha Gautama, before he got enlightened, would have remembered the teachings he had heard himself from Kassapa, the previous Buddha. That was his teacher. That was the gunpowder. Together with his jhanas, that's where he got his enlightenment from. He was not perfectly self-enlightened. Yeah, you know, he did it himself. There's no teacher alive now, but his memory from his past lives would have given him the Dhamma, together with the jhanas, to be able to get enlightenment. That was where his samadhi came from. Logical, isn't it? In fact, it's obvious. But he's radical, he's heretical. That's why I like being a heretic. Dear Ajahn, considering Angulimala was responsible for his decisions and actions, how did he manage to let go of his past karma to become aligned? He was responsible, but when you realize what non-self is, you can actually let it go. You can forgive. Already mentioned, you can forgive everything. He could forgive 999 or 99 murders. You can actually let that go. Which is an amazing story. So if he could let that go, surely you can let things go. Are feelings of guilt the consequence of bad action karma related? The feelings of guilt come with the confluence of bad karma and delusion, stupidity. And that's where we get guilt from. If you don't have any bad karma, you don't have any guilt. If you don't have any stupidity, no delusion, then also you don't have guilt. How can one separate responsibility from guilt and let it go? Understand oneself. The last question of this retreat, I hope it's a good one. What does it mean, setting the Dharma wheel in motion? And why is it unstoppable? Because I mentioned once you've heard these teachings, you can't forget them. You might try to forget them. I don't want to be a Buddhist anymore. It's just too hard. Be a Christian, then you can have sex and go to heaven. It's really nice being a Christian. You don't have to do very much. You can just break all your precepts and just go and ask forgiveness on a Saturday. And everything is forgiven. Wonderful, isn't it? Because then you can go to heaven, you can be the total scallywag. All you need to do is to believe in Jesus and you're saved. Hallelujah. But it doesn't make any sense at all. It doesn't work either. As I told Ajahn Brahmani the other day, Jesus couldn't even save himself. Think about it. Come on. You thought that was very funny. Maybe I'll get into trouble with that. Please take it off the talk. But setting the Dharma wheel in motion is this: once the Buddha sees this Dharma just and starts teaching it, it just spreads and you can't stop it. I mean, obviously, that once you start hearing about letting go and non-self and all this sort of stuff, it just, yeah, you know, may not like it, but you just can't ignore it and it just keeps on going. And it's, even for myself, when I first heard these teachings, there was something about them which was so different from all these other teachings. And it wasn't beliefs. This was actually showing you how to find these things out. And it just made so much sense. It just smelt right. And of course, you practice more and more, you think, my goodness, it's not just a smell right, it is right. You understand just how wonderful it is. It's such a great relief to know there's no one in here. So there is an end of suffering possible. Otherwise, there's someone in here that's not going to end suffering. Heaven, hells, all this sort of stuff. There can't ever be a heaven forever after. Even as a kid at school, I realized that was absolutely impossible. Heaven forever after. You can't have just happiness. The happiness disappears after a while. It doesn't change. If you have a little bit more happiness one day, a little bit less happiness next day, the less happiness is called suffering. It's just the different levels of happiness. So you can't just have just happiness, 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 happiness. It's just absolutely impossible. So you have happiness and suffering. As I've mentioned to many of you before, all happiness is the space between two moments of suffering. All suffering is the space between two moments of happiness. You can't have suffering without happiness. You can't have happiness without suffering. So your life, now happy, now suffering, now having a beautiful meditation, now being frustrated, that is par for the course. Welcome to samsara. There's no way that you can avoid that. except by just disappearing. So you have no happiness, no suffering. The end of all of that. And why is it unstoppable? Because, again, the teachings are true, and because they're true, just you can't ignore it. And you know, whatever you do, whatever you say, even if you don't teach anything, you don't open your mouth, just who you are would affect some of the other people. So, it's unstoppable. There is no brake on the vehicle. There is no way of going down the gears and stopping the engine. It's run away, tearing away, down the hill of samsara to nirvana at the bottom of the hill. Oh, what a wonderful idea that is. At last, the terminus, an end to all things. That's one of the things which I remember Ajahn Chah saying. Throughout his whole life, he was interested in things ending. Because all the other things he saw in life, just they kept on continuing on without an end to it. You know, getting married, it's got no an end to it, it just keeps on dragging on. You know, studying, this is always another exam to do. Work, there's always another day to go to work. And even when you retire, you still have to work. It goes on and on and on and on and on. Surely there must be an end to things. And that's why the Buddha taught the end of things. Things stopping. And that end, things stopping. What was that simile I gave? Sometimes that when you let go of things, it's like you're a bird. You fly in the air. And there's no place to land. No place to roost your sense of self or ego. So you fly in the air. Because there's no place to go. You just vanish in the air. And that's what you do. No place to find a home. No resting place in the sense of no attachments, no grasping, no me. Nothing to tie yourself down. So you just fly off. That's enlightenment. So now, fly and vanish. Don't stick anywhere. If you stick somewhere, you just create another life. So, that's what we call just the end of all things. The end of all questions. I hope for the next retreat, this basket will be full again. So that is the last question of the question time. I hope you enjoyed it and had fun and had some deep answers as well and some jokes. What was the joke I told about? I told the joke about the Jesus and sending the guy with the suitcase. And what was that really stupid joke? Oh, about the kayak. You can't have your kayak and eat it. So you had some fun, we had some deep stuff and controversial stuff. So I hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you enjoyed the buffet this evening. The night is still young. This is your last night at the retreat center. And I know that you have to pay at least $100. Many of you put donations in. We just took them out of the box today. So if you want to get your money's worth, if you want to drink and squeeze every moment out of this retreat, when it comes to sleeping, just remember, you can sleep as much as you like when you're in your coffin. Now you're alive. Now just take it easy. If you think you've got energy, meditate. Don't be afraid of sort of not sleeping. But if you are tired, try the Ananda method. If you wake up in the middle of the night, get up and try the Ananda method again. Maximize your opportunities. Okay, so thank you. Now, three over-the-top sadhus. Sadhu. 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 Very good. And see you in the morning.